In 2006, I left a relatively cushy job as an associate rector at All Saints Episcopal Church in Beverly Hills, California, in order to pursue a dream. I left an established traditional church in order to become the founder of an Episcopal church that we called Thads, for Thaddeus, one of the 12 disciples that really all we know about him is his name. And the mission was to engage a constituency of people that might never be engaged in an otherwise traditional Episcopal church setting. It was a dream, and it was fraught with many challenges as well. I left a pretty comfortable, established, beautiful Episcopal church with a church with no building and very few people. And on my first day, in the first office day of that church, I met with one of my partners in establishing this new ministry in the garage of a woman named Jill, who was a part of the establishment of this new Episcopal church. Our first church office was a garage. When we had to use the restroom, we walked across the street into the park in Culver City, California, and used the park restrooms in order to go to the bathroom, and came back to a garage where we had placed my grandparents' dining room table around which we worked. Because we didn't have a building, we had to find a place to have our staff meetings. Now, to be clear, our staff existed of me, a guy named Quentin, a woman named Cindy, my wife, who worked part-time engaging in children and youth ministry. And then there were another handful of people that I called affectionately my volunteer staff. And because we needed a place in order to hold these staff meetings, we found not too far away from the garage where our office was a Jewish deli in Culver City, California called Roll in Rye. It was a classic Jewish deli that when you landed at the table and we occupied a very comfortable corner booth with our six or seven people every week, and when you sat down at the table, they delivered you pickles and bagel chips. And over pickles and bagel chips for at least 6 or 7 years, nearly every single Tuesday from 4 to 6 p.m., we had a staff meeting. Now, because I was, for the first time in my career, completely in charge, and also there was no tradition that I had to be responsive and sensitive to. If you think, like, when I came to a place like this, I might have fresh ideas, but I'm joining a 100-year-old church that has traditions and expectations. And so it becomes the leader or the rector's responsibility to be responsive to those. But in an experiment, in a church plant, in a brand new church, there's no tradition. So somebody like me can basically, for the most part, do whatever I want. And so that's what I did in those staff meetings. I, for the first time in my career, ran a staff meeting just as I would run it, just as my heart's desire would have it run. It was a 2-hour meeting. For 1 hour, we studied the Bible. And we studied the Bible that we would be reading in church upcoming. And I used that first hour as like a bit of a listening session, think tank kind of group. I would bring passages from the scripture that were coming up in church in the coming Sundays. And then I would, for the most part, just say, like, well, read this. And then tell me, like, what you're thinking or what you're feeling. And then in the second hour, we did any kind of administration or logistics or governance that we needed to do in order to pull off church Sunday to Sunday to Sunday. With this experiment, which to some degree, in a slightly different incarnation, has carried over to our staff meetings here at St. John's, in that first hour, there was this rich engagement with the story of the biblical narrative itself. And it created a community where we grew in trust pretty quickly. Because engaging the story like that with a measure of intensity can be somewhat disruptive and vulnerable. And within the first 6 months, there was this beautiful learning that I got, which I've carried through for the last 20 years now into my experience as a pastor and a preacher. What I found is there would be particular passages from the Bible that we might encounter from time to time that could not be ignored. Like, no matter what, if I woke up this morning and I was like, golly gee whiz, the 23rd Psalm is my favorite psalm, and I can't wait to preach about that. One of those people around the table would say, like, I don't know what you plan to preach about, Jimmy, but what I know is you can't ignore this whole thing about Jesus being a gate. When we hear that teaching from Jesus, I am the gate. I am the gatekeeper. Even though it's followed by this passage of I am the good shepherd, in our current cultural context, it demands some commentary. And it demands commentary because in American religious culture, particularly in American Christianity, we've evolved into this institutional church that across the board, and maybe present company excluded, at least for the most part, the Christian faith is embodied in such a way that there are those who are in and there are those who are out, that there are winners and there are losers. And that, when we hear it in that way, and I certainly understand when we hear it in that way, but that is not the message that Jesus is intending to communicate. There is a deeper message that is informed out of Jewish context that Christianity inherits kind of quietly in its meta-narrative, and that Islam inherits more proactively and deliberately on its mystical side of expression. Now, what in the heck am I talking about? There is in Jewish culture, there was in Jesus's time, and there is today in Jewish culture, a concept called Hamza. And Hamza was a commentary about God as God interacts with humanity. And Hamza is depicted in a very particular symbol, both in Jewish culture, even until today, and Islamic culture. And the symbol that no doubt that many of you have seen is this. I've written on my hand this morning the symbol of Hamza so that you can see it. It has its derivation from Miriam, the sister of Moses, who has this really open and positive and loving orientation to God for the most part of the story. Hamza is a symbol of protection. But even this symbol requires some explanation within our own cultural context. Because in the development of American Christianity over the last 250 or so years, we've come to learn through the expression of the institutional church, I don't mean to say that it's necessarily in the story itself, and I certainly don't mean to say necessarily that it's theologically sound, but we've come to learn because we've been taught that this world in which we inhabit is a dark and scary place, and that the world itself has somewhat of an incarnation, and that incarnation is coming for you, and it is coming for me, and we need protection from that incarnation. And the way that we get protection from that incarnation is going to church, and not just going to church, but giving a lot of your money to church too. We get this idea that the world is a place to be feared. But Hamza is not oriented in that way to the world. Hamza is oriented in a little bit of a twist or a turning that reality upside down. Hamza and the culture of Hamza is just meant to communicate to you and to me and to all of us that you are not unguarded in this life, that you have been and you always will be under the coverage in a relationship connected to God, who we know to be love, who intends benevolence and beauty for your life. It's more of a positive connection. As I was driving down to Astoria Hot Springs for campfire with the sound bowls and the soak last Sunday, and thinking about the preaching upcoming this week, I turned to this phrase, everything's gonna be okay. And it can be a comforting phrase for us, right? I mean, I can tell you, if my 103-year-old grandmother, Mary Carolyn Hoag, who still lives by herself in her home in Tulsa, Oklahoma, if in our Sunday afternoon conversation, my grandmother, Mary Carolyn, tells me everything's gonna be okay, I believe her and I feel it, and it means something to me because she knows me and she knows my life. But if a relative stranger, even a well-intentioned Christian, sees the chaos, and like, I'll just use my own life as an example right now. If a relative stranger sees the chaos of my life over the course of the last year, divorce and cancer, the real tragedies, the very real tragedies that I have and continue to endure, and because they see the real tragedy in my life, it makes them so uncomfortable that they chirp back to me, everything's gonna be okay, then that means very little to me, right? The same phrase with a different orientation. Hamza is bringing us that grandmotherly echo of everything's going to be okay. Now, if we were to just step back from the reality that we have to straddle as American Christians, as those who are seeking equanimity at a time of, an era of, a season of real chaos within the context, not just of the church, but the culture of at large. If we need a lens to see this through, I would offer this one. No doubt many of you in this room have heard of the phrase toxic positivity. Do you know this phrase? Yes, you do. Some of you do. Do you know the person who embodies it? You know that anxious, fearful person who, no matter what, uses all of his or her energy to try to stiff arm suffering or tragedy or sorrow or confusion at every single angle, and to do it through like putting a smile on your face, turning that frown upside down, and just cannot acknowledge that chaos exists within the culture and also within their own life? I would call that toxic positivity. That is not Hamza. Hamza is more of a reflection of what we would get from the Austrian scholar Viktor Frankl's work. Now, there's no doubt in my mind that at least a few of you in this church have read Frankl's masterpiece, Man's Search for Meaning. It's a powerful read, and it is worth your time and attention if you haven't already taken the tour. And even, you know, if you took the tour in junior year in college, like Western civilization, it's worth your time to take the tour again. Frankl uses this concept that he calls tragic optimism. It's a beautiful phrase of where humanity, human beings, individually and collectively, acknowledge the reality, the full reality of our existence. That we acknowledge both the tragedy and the sorrow and the great joy and the great blessing, and we orient our lives in the direction that we would find some meaning in those things coming together. And that meaning would propel us forward in life rather than paralyze us in the chaos of our current context or reality. Now, if you just took a tour of Frankl on Wikipedia or ChatGPT Plus, I don't think it would give you this part of the story. So some of you know that Frankl is a survivor of the concentration camps. And honestly, like not just a survivor of the concentration camps, but a survivor of the concentration camps and ultimately Auschwitz, a place where almost everyone died, a place of unimaginable horror and suffering. And so Frankl's book gets published after he's liberated from the concentration camps. But when you begin to poke your nose deeper into his life, you learn somewhat marvelously and somewhat tragically that Frankl begins to play around with tragic optimism in the 30s. And that Frankl smuggles and hides the text of Man's Search for Meaning into the concentration camps. That the concentration camps themselves become the laboratory, the grotesque laboratory for Frankl to audition his theory of tragic optimism. And when he is liberated from his experience in Auschwitz and begins to come back together, he then publishes this book and delivers this content to the globe. It is a beautiful and a sorrowful tale. Here we sit in the context of Easter, which is also, if you give it some thought, a beautiful and sorrowful tale. If I say the word Easter, no doubt what automatically pops into your mind is a pastel-colored Easter egg, seersucker, or maybe a distant cross with an empty tomb. But what we know from both the narrative and the real tradition of the church is that Easter is really a meta-narrative of our life itself. It includes violence, and it includes miraculous love, and it includes all the frustration and confusion that is in between those two things. In order for us to move ourselves along or to deepen our affiliation with the narrative and the faith that I would distinguish over and against the institution that can be somewhat toxically positive, in order for us to orient ourselves and become disciples of or apprentices of the narrative and the faith, we must acknowledge the whole Easter. We must scratch our heads around while Mary doesn't recognize Jesus in the garden, or why these two guys who are so taken with the experience from crucifixion to resurrection don't recognize Jesus on a road from one place to another as they tell the story of the current events of the day. That they don't recognize him until they sit down at a table and he picks up a loaf of bread and breaks it in half. We need an Easter that includes both fear and violence and tragedy, and also the miraculous, hopeful love that emerges on Sunday. And we need that because that's how we really live, if we're honest and transparent about our experiences as human beings. We need to be able to grapple with the confusion of, like, what do you mean you say you're the gate? If I were an intellectual preaching to you, rather than somebody who's just a preacher trying to find meaning and purchase in this story and trying to pass it on, if I was an intellectual, I would say, like, oh yeah, Jesus says, I am the gate. Did you know there's 7 I am messages from John's gospel? And of course, we also remember that that harkens back to Moses' experience with God in the burning bush, where God identifies God's self as being itself. I am who I am is the name that God uses. But I don't believe that that intellectual approach does us a lick of good as we are trying to find traction in the chaos of our lives individually and collectively. You know, there's this curious turn. This passage that we have, you heard Travis say, like, it's Good Shepherd Sunday. Well, sort of it is. In year A, we don't even get to the Good Shepherd. There are 2 I am statements of this particular pericope. One is I am the gate or the gatekeeper, and the other is I am the Good Shepherd. But there is a hinge between these 2 passages, these 2 I am statements. And it's a curious hinge, and it's a hinge that in America requires some cultural translation again. You heard Jesus at the end of our gospel this morning say, I came to bring you abundant life. Like, I came so that you would live abundantly. And when we hear that word through our American enculturated brains, we hear, ah, abundance. What a wonderful concept. Maybe we even visualize the cornucopia or a pot of gold or an overflowing 401k. Let me be clear. We live in a culture that despises lack and craves ease. And there is a collaboration with toxic positivity that happens in a dance between these two realities. Because that stiff-arming that we do never really works out. And one of the great things about living in Teton County, Wyoming, the wealthiest zip code or zip codes in the United States of America, is for the most part, some of us in this congregation know that it doesn't matter how much money you have, that that's not exactly what provides safety and security and meaning and purpose in our lives. So when Jesus says, I came so that you would have life, and that life would be abundant, he doesn't mean that your life would be trouble-free. He means that your life would be full and rich and include everything, and that you would be protected by a measure of Hamza, that Hamza is a part of our very experience in human being, as human beings. If you're around this church this Sunday, or 3 out of 4 Sundays, you know the clergy, 3 out of 4 Sundays, take our kids out of this part of our collective worship and teaching and sacramental experience into their own experience. And I don't know what the other clergy do when they do that, because I'm not in the room. I'm up here, or I'm right here doing my thing while they're doing it. But I can tell you what I do. I take those kids into the room and say I have 9 to 13 minutes. And I ask one of them to read the gospel that we have for today. So the kids would be in there reading about Jesus being the gate or something. And if I have 9 to 13 minutes, that takes about 7 minutes for a second grader to get through a very adult story that is not oriented to kids at all. And then after they read it, I use maybe like 90 more seconds to like just see if there's anything that bubbles up, any kind of question that bubbles up from them. And sometimes something does, and sometimes something doesn't. And then in the last 30 seconds, Sunday after Sunday with our kids, I usually say to them, I just say like, I've got work to do. I got to get back in this place. They're, you know, your parents don't know. They're lost. Y'all are going to be fine. Gene's going to do some crafts with you, but I got to get out of here. So hear me. If there is one thing, that I want you to remember from this story, here's what it is. And I deliver them something there. Because you see, I will tell you that from where I sit in my chair, both in this church for the last 10 years and in my last church for 15 years, I only want 1.5 things from kids in church. The first thing that I want, the first full thing that I want, is for them to have fun. I want them to have a positive experience in this place so that maybe someday when they're growing up or when they're grown up and they think about church, they remember that experience positively. You know, I was in a church for 15 years in Los Angeles. which is the very epicenter of every health trend, real or imaginary, that comes to America. And at least quarterly, for 15 years, an earnest parent would come to me and they would say, like, "Jimmy, love what you built here. Thad's is a beautiful experience. My family loves this church. We come here every week. We get so much out of it. But man, the donuts, they're poison. My kid eats six of them before we get home, and it's a total disaster. Don't you see? We've got to get rid of the donuts." To which I always responded, "Look, let me be absolutely clear. If you take donuts away from church, you take the only positive memory I have of church as a child. So for as long as I am here and I am your rector, there will be donuts here. And donuts are not a church problem. They are a parenting problem. If your kid eats six donuts at church, that is your problem, not my problem, because I am just trying to deliver them some fun." And then the other half thing that I wanted them to remember is, if they can, if there's some way that they can, if they can remember this story that we have, this Jewish Christian story that plays out across millennia and informs the way that we connect and the way that we move through our lives. Because I know that there is power in the mythopoetic narrative of the Jewish Christian story. And I know if we can get out of our academic minds and we can push it down into our lives, it can help us live. It can help us find balance and equanimity when we find ourselves in a season of, or an era of, chaos. So, church, if there is one thing, if there is one thing that I want you to remember from this story today, if you can only remember one thing, I want you to remember this. You are not unguarded in this life that you live. And no matter what chaos or tragedy or sorrow comes your way, everything is going to be okay.